ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When you're in a medical emergency, when something is going horribly wrong, you hope that emergency services will act quickly. But in regional Australia, infrastructure issues can delay life-saving treatment.
The whole thing could have been avoided if she'd got there before the second occurrence at 1:30. There's every chance that they could have, saved her life.
Shortly, we'll head to South Australia's Riverland, where the closure of hospital helipads means choppers are simply unavailable for patients in critical emergencies. And later in the program, I'll take you to a tiny island at the bottom of Australia for a round of golf on what may be the most relaxed course in the country.
It's a place to come and nobody worries about anything except the golf.
I'm Alex Barwick and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Mbantua Alice Springs. In a health crisis, being able to access medical care quickly can be a matter of life and death. And in the regions, there are always hurdles. Long distances to travel, not enough staff, often no immediate access to the very much needed specialists. In regional South Australia, safety issues have delayed the reopening of 6 regional South Australian hospital helipads. And there's growing concern in the communities affected, particularly after the death of one Renmark woman who was left waiting hours to be transported to Adelaide. Riverland reporter Shannon Pearce has the story. Thanks for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks so much.
What were the safety issues across these hospital helipads?
The state government, back in March 2024, I'm going to take you back about 18 months, the government committed $23 million to upgrade 13 regional hospital helipads across regional South Australia to be brought into line with the Civil Aviation Safety Authorities. But once they started constructing these, those regulations had another change. Basically, now we have 6 regional helipads that have had all their major construction works completed, but they can't be certified because they don't meet these new standards.
And what did the closure of one helipad mean for Renmark woman Jane Logas?
Jane, her story is really, really unfortunate. It was September 20 this year, and she suffered a heart attack over here in Renmark, where I'm based. And so she was transported to the hospital, which is the next town over. It's about a 15 or so minute drive, sometimes 20. And they've got the hospital there, which where you'd normally have a helipad. This one, however, was not operational because it wasn't open yet after these upgrades. I will say it has since been opened just last week, but at the time, they didn't have access to it. And as her condition deteriorated after her heart attack, they decided they needed to get her to Adelaide. And the way that they had to do that, because they didn't have access to this helipad, was bring her all the way back to Renmark to use the airstrip there for an air ambulance plane to take her to Adelaide. Really sadly, that plane, they ended up having to wait a number of hours for that plane, and she died just as she was on the tarmac waiting for it, which is really, really unfortunate. But her husband, Paul, he feels very passionately about the fact that if there was a helipad there, there's the possibility it may have had a different outcome because they wouldn't have had to wait or spend so much time travelling in between.
You know, I mean, the whole thing could have been avoided if it takes 45 minutes for a helicopter to come from Adelaide to Berry. In 45 minutes return, she could have been in the hospital before midnight. They would have done an emergency operation on her. And I mean, she had a serious problem because her heart had ruptured. But, you know, they've got the facilities there that they can actually do something to that. You know, if she'd got there before the second occurrence at 1:30, there's every chance that they could have, saved her life.
Shannon, what have you been hearing across the communities affected?
So this is something that is really top of mind for our communities here in regional South Australia, particularly from what we've heard here with our local community in the Riverland. There's some increasing concern. The longer that these remain non-operational, the longer people are sort of starting to get a little bit worried about what that might mean for people. I've been told that in some places they haven't seen helicopters for months, even years. And our local member and also opposition for our current state government said to us that this is the plight, essentially, of regional communities. Tim Whetstone was telling us that it's something that regional communities really have to deal with when it comes to healthcare.
People have the right to ask questions. Could this death have been avoided if that helipad had been operational? And sadly, through the bungled operations of making that helipad compliant, I am an advocate for regional health. I am an advocate for the Riverland having satisfactory outcomes when it comes to helipads being rolled out on time and making sure that that helipad is part of a good regional health outcome.
This is crucial. What's being done about these safety issues across the helipads?
The government hasn't given us timelines of when they expect these six helipads to come back online, and they haven't really said what are possible ways of dealing with it. The government basically says that it's up to the helicopter operator to sign off on the safety certification, and that neither the minister or SA Health can make the decision that they're safe to use or certify those helipads. So we're in a bit of a question mark space at the moment. And so what we have heard from them is that SA Health is working with the operator through the process, including completion of safety assessments for these helipads to open. They've said that there are alternative landing sites, as we've discussed. Our state government has tasked the CEO of the Riverland Mallee Coorong Local Health Network, Wayne Champion, to basically coordinate the response to this issue and how they're going to solve it. He said that it's pretty complex and that the solutions are going to need to vary.
To be brought into use, helipads need to be certified for use by the helicopter operator. And the helicopter operator in particular needs to ensure that it's safe for the helicopter crew and for people on the ground at the time the helicopter's taking off and landing, and that the helipads comply with the CASA requirements. And the CASA requirements have changed during the period of construction for the helipads, which is complicated things. So the design and location of the helipads is at odds with some of the CASA requirements, and therefore some of those helipads haven't yet been certified for use by the helicopter operator.
And Shannon, have you heard from the helicopter companies involved?
So the helicopter operator, Babcock, we received a short statement from them that they're committed to safety and are working with the state government, but they did direct our questions to SA Health.
Shannon, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Reporter Shannon Pearce in the Riverland.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
To Tasmania's west coast, in regional areas with patchy reception, cash is still essential for so many small businesses. Last month, the federal government released draft legislation for a cash mandate, requiring businesses to keep accepting cash. But as bank branches close down and more people move towards card payment, some country towns are finding themselves quite literally running out of cold hard cash. Kim Napier has this story.
Using the ATM in the middle of Rosebery is a normal part of Sandy Marsh's routine. But lately, there's been an issue.
It's been out since last Thursday.
That's a full week.
It's a full week.
The ATM is out of cash. Like many people on Tasmania's west coast, Rosebery resident Sandy relies on physical money.
A lot of people here do not do banking on their phone, and they're very dependent on the ATM in the middle of the town.
Tassie's West is a picturesque place. Wide streets and old buildings are nestled at the foot of some truly majestic mountains. It's beautiful, but isolated. People often have to drive hours to access services like healthcare, education, and now money.
People are getting really upset. They have to drive to Zion to go to their ATM. I don't know if theirs has got any left in it.
The decline of the mining industry in recent years has seen the population of the West Coast plummet, and towns are pivoting to tourism to diversify their economies. But Sandy points out that tourism only works if tourists can buy stuff, and to do that, they need cash. She's worried about the effect the lack of cash will have on a market planned for this weekend.
Well, our market doesn't have Wi-Fi inside the hall, and the tourists depend on the ATM.
Problems with cash in Tasmania's west have been happening for a while. In nearby Queenstown, Bendigo Bank recently closed its physical branch and ATM, making it one of many country towns around Australia which have lost their physical bank branch. Residents can use a service at the Queenstown Post Office, but the post office has been posting to social media, pleading with locals to come spend cash to restock their dwindling float. The West Coast Wilderness Railway is one of the largest businesses in Queenstown. The general manager is Ian Robertson, and he now has to bank through the post office.
We've had to increase our floats considerably. We had to make modifications to our safe so that we could store the cash. And we are having to pay for small change. It's not becoming to change coins at the post office isn't free, so we're having to pay for that. What's happening in Rosebery right now really says it all. The town's ATM there has clearly run out of cash. It's just another example of how fragile access to money has become right across the West Coast. So now, from Rosebery to Zeehan to Queenstown, that's the triangle on the West Coast. People can't even get access to their own money.
Even the region's tourism body notes it's an issue. On the website designed for visitors, a note reads,
"Don't expect a cashless visit. It's not that we're backwards and behind the times, we just live a little more simply. And our internet connections can sometimes be unreliable. Best to make sure you have some cash just in case that little cafe with the best coffee or local artist with the landscape painting you desperately want don't have FPOS. Also, our towns have ATMs, but cash can run out quickly."
There's been speculation a transport workers' strike might be the reason the ATM in Rosebery hasn't been filled up. The ABC has contacted the Transport Workers' Union for comment and has also reached out to Bendigo Bank. All this comes amid a wider discussion about cash use in Australia. The federal government last month announced draft legislation around a cash mandate, which would force businesses like servos and grocery stores to keep accepting cash. But under that legislation, there are exemptions for small businesses. In any case, for the towns in Tasmania's west, not having access to cash isn't just about the money.
It's just not inconvenient. It's a sign that the regional communities are being left behind in some of the most basic ways. And for older people and small business owners, anyone who still deals in cash, this is devastating.
Kim Napier with that story from Tasmania's west coast.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
We're going to head now to the small outback town of Elliot. It's about 3 hours north of Tennant Creek in the Northern Territory. It's near here that ambitious plans have been brewing over several years to build Australia's largest solar farm. And now that plan has scaled up again. The company, Suncable, has lodged expansion plans for the site on the Aboriginal-owned Muckaty Station. Darwin reporter Matt Garrick has the story. Matt, what has Suncable proposed in the middle of the outback?
As you said earlier, Alex, this is a grand plan, this expansive vision for Australia's largest solar farm out there at Powell Creek Station. Now, through documents lodged with the Environment Protection Authority, we've seen that the company is planning to build this second solar farm out on Muckaty Station. It's a similar scale of a farm. It's the first one is about 12,000 hectares they're aiming for. So it's we don't know the exact size yet, but one thing we do know is it is likely to be this large scale energy generating solar project out there in the middle of the outback.
So what does this site look like now, and how would it transform with this enormous solar farm?
Well, you've taken the drive, Alex, between Alice Springs and Darwin, and you know especially around that area north of Tennant Creek, it's just hours after hours of this flat expanse of landscape just no real masses of trees or anything. Of course, there's huge amounts of ground vegetation, but it's this red dirt, long distance expanse of essentially land that would be transformed into solar panel after solar panel. This huge kilometers wide project to harness the energy from the outback sun and turn it into power to generate the Northern Territory, parts of the Northern Territory, and perhaps even further afield.
Yeah, how much energy are we talking? How much energy does SunCable believe it could produce? And what exactly would it be used for?
Basically, they're saying that it would be to supplement the main station, the main solar farm at neighbouring Powell Creek Station. Here's a little bit of how much SunCable Chief Executive Ryan Williamson-Bell told the NT Country Hour that it could generate.
The customers that we talk to are very energy-intensive industries. They want to know not only can you provide the first couple of hundred megawatts, but that over time that we can continue to build out the acreage and we can continue to supply them right up to the sorts of large gigawatt scale kind of energy demand that they will have. And that's the reason why we have Powell Creek and we are now investigating Muckaty Station, is to be able to give that certainty to customers that we can meet the energy demands of the future.
Matt, Muckaty Station has been in and out of the headlines over the years. What's its history?
Well, it's certainly a very interesting part of the world, Alex, for somewhere so isolated to have grabbed so many national headlines over the year. Perhaps most recently and most high profile, about a decade ago, a little bit more than a decade, it was the subject of a contentious proposal to house a nuclear waste dump. That plan was eventually rejected, but not after a long and drawn-out debate, protests, and, of course, people pushing for that to go ahead. So that didn't go ahead. And Alice Springs historian Alex Nelson, he actually wrote to me this morning to say that many years ago, in 1989, it was sold to a Japanese consortium, the station there, which intended to build a $200 million exclusive resort featuring a dude ranch and 18-hole golf course. Needless to say, that didn't happen. And now here we are at the latest iteration of Muckaty Station's colourful history to become the home of what could be one of the world's largest solar precincts.
Which begs the question, how likely is this latest grand plan?
To the bosses of SunCable, it is likely. They're pushing now for the approvals. It's in with the Environment Protection Authority. The Northern Land Council has confirmed to the ABC that it is engaging with SunCable over the Muckaty plans. So they're hopeful that it will go ahead. They're looking at this area that's about 50,000 hectares in size, as Mr. Williamson-Bell said. Here's a little bit about what he said about what it could do for the future if it does go ahead.
What we have identified at the moment is approximately 50,000 hectares that we believe is developable. Now, that amount of land, that's a very significant amount of land. We're not suggesting that all of that will be developed for solar, but that's the area of interest on the site that we are investigating at the moment.
So what's going to happen next for this to actually progress?
Well, there's been these long negotiations taking place between SunCable and the Northern Land Council and the various traditional owner groups that exist in that great expanse of land. So the next thing that needs to happen is for those agreements to come to fruition. There is some hope that that will happen potentially as soon as this year. So watch this space. The SunCable project, this huge expansive vision for the outback, looks like it is slowly stepping closer and closer. The Muckaty Station proposal may take a little bit longer as it's more fledgling than the neighbouring Powell Creek, but there seems to be movement at the station and it looks like SunCable is at least becoming bullish and speaking publicly about it, that it will happen.
Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ali.
Darwin-based reporter Matt Garrick there. It's good to have your company. My name's Alex Barwick. You're listening to Australia Wide. We head now to the tiny island of Cape Barron off the northeast coast of Tasmania. It's almost the weekend, so we're off for a round of golf. And while the sport of golf is stereotypically associated with rich businessmen and high flyers, on this island, there's a community teeing off quite differently. Louise Milan has the story.
On the fairways of Truana, Cape Barron Island, things are a little unexpected. You won't find any tailored trousers or neatly pressed polos here, but you'll score an advantage if a crow steals your ball. And while some players have a decent shot, it's safe to say no one on this island is turning pro.
It's a place to come and nobody worries about anything except the golf, because they know me and I want people to relax, and we don't have no carry-on or anything like that.
That's John Gardner. For this golf course, he's everything.
Greenkeeper, the manager, the organiser, player, do everything.
A few times a week, you'll find John on the mower, tending the course he's been instrumental in creating. It's called the Marijuana Golf Course.
It was a bit of a play on words for me, and it's different.
John assures me the club doesn't promote drugs, but it makes for an interesting sign. And John likes his signs. They're dotted around the course, marking the names of holes. Some are funny, like the long drop. Others pay tribute to community members who've died. Truana, Cape Barron Island sits off the northeast coast of Tasmania. It's home to around 80 people, most of whom are Indigenous. The Tasmanian government handed this land back to the Aboriginal community in 2005. Now, the island is run entirely by the community, the only place in the state that's governed this way.
Oh, beautiful!
Golf is a tourist draw card for Tasmania. Over on King Island, Cape Wickham Links was recently named the best golf course in the country by Australian Golf Digest. A game there will set you back hundreds of dollars in greens fees. The views at Marijuana rival that of any prestigious course in the country. You can see beautiful wild hills, clear blue waters, and the mountain range on neighbouring Flinders Island stands on the horizon. But like the land it sits on, this course isn't meant for rich tourists. John made it for locals, and both entry and golf clubs are completely free.
It's all set up to not make things too hard for anybody.
On the weekend I visit, there's a memorial game for a much-loved community member who died a few years ago.
I'm Brooke Burke. So today I was the first female to win the Sharon Shuffle Pairs Championship. I've been coming here for 3 years doing the championship since my auntie passed away, and we do this game as a tribute to her, and today I won.
How's that feel?
Great.
Every Friday, there's a hole-in-one competition. Local Luana Towney is a regular, and like many people here, the first time she played golf was on this course.
It doesn't matter if you're good at golf or not. People support you 100%. People laugh at each other and laugh at themselves, which is the main thing.
One of the best players on the island is Tim Maynard. His name holds multiple coveted spots in the shed that serves as a clubhouse. But Tim's not in it for the glory.
I reckon it feels better when someone else gets a good shot and celebrate and join in it. Yeah.
And that pretty well sums up the spirit of this golf course. Everyone has a go, no matter your ability or agility. Unconventionally, John's actually put backboards on some greens to give people a better chance. And he's always there to coach, even me.
Too far. I reckon you're standing too far away from it. That's better. Well, you're on.
We're on.
Buck Brown is a senior ranger on the island. He says this place is about more than golf.
A lot of camaraderie, and it's one of the strongest things I've seen in this community. Actually pull the community together has been this golf club. In a way, I've seen it get a lot of people out of the houses in the community. Well, it's actually got them out of the house and out walking on country.
And for John, he's pretty pleased when he sees people enjoying his course, and he gets a lot of joy from being out here too.
Especially the day after I've mowed. Because there's a certain smell out here then when you've got fresh cut grass, and especially you come out in the morning, the sun's shining and all the mountains are on, you know, it's beautiful.
John Gardner from Marijuana Golf Course, ending that story from Louise Milan on Truana, Cape Barron Island. And finally to outback Queensland, where the last thing you'd expect to see is a tropics-dwelling creature like a cassowary. There have been multiple sightings of a cassowary near the town of Mount Surprise. It's about 200 kilometres southwest of Cairns since late September. It's raised questions about how on earth it got there and if authorities should intervene. Shani Kim has the story.
No one believed that it was a cassowary when I was talking to everyone.
On a recent visit back to his ancestral Uruman country in Queensland's dry and grassy Gulf savannah, the last thing Bronson Richards expected to see was a cassowary.
Yeah, it was just crossing the road. We just drove in to Mount Surprise. We were going for a swim, the creek right next to it, which is Elizabeth Creek. And as we drove out of Discovery Parks, we seen a male cassowary, which is quite odd considering it's a very long way from the rainforest. When I was telling my dad's lived in Mount Surprise pretty much nearly his whole life, never seen a cassowary. When I told him, he said, "Are you sure it's not an emu?" But I know the difference between an emu and a cassowary. And mate, it was definitely a cassowary. It's gone for a walkabout.
Luckily, Bronson got a photo and showed his uncle, David Hudson.
He sent me the photo and said, "Hey, young Dave, look at this." He said, "Have a guess where it is." I said, "Oh, green, dry grass, probably Mariba." He says, "Nah, Mount Surprise." I was like, "What? Are you joking me?" I thought he was pulling my leg too.
There have since been more sightings of the bird around Mount Surprise, including by a helicopter pilot who filmed it running through grassland. The area is about 150 kilometres from the nearest rainforest, so bird experts like ecologist Daryl Jones from Griffith University are a bit baffled.
This would have to be on the top of the list of the weirdest things, the most unlikely thing I could possibly imagine, really, to see a bird like that out there so far from where it should be and looking happy and lively and pretty and having a great time, apparently. So very strange situation, and I'm completely flabbergasted.
The southern cassowary typically lives in dense rainforest and woodlands full of fruiting trees in Papua New Guinea and far north Queensland, where about 4,000 are thought to remain. Some wildlife carers like Will Kemp, who also drives the Savannah Lander train through Mount Surprise, are worried about this particular bird's welfare in the hot, dry conditions.
I worked in zoos for about a decade. A big part of my job was to look after cassowaries in captivity. So, you know, I used to feed them about 5 kilos of mixed fruit a day. That's a lot of fruit, a lot of fruit that a rainforest, you know, can provide. When it comes to savanna grasslands, I just cannot see how it is feeding itself with that much fruit, especially this time of year. It's the dry season. We've had a lot of fire activity out there. So if you could find a scat, you could have a look in there. I mean, if it's full of bananas and peach pits and blueberry skins or whatever, okay, we know it's being fed by a person. If it's got, you know, native seeds, fruits, animal bits in it, I guess that'd probably just make a lot of us feel a bit more easy about it all. If it's out there and it's doing its own thing and it's healthy, that's great. If it's going to start a slow, gradual starvation until it finally dies, that's not nice, you know, especially for an endangered animal that we're trying to look after and breed more of.
Vet Graham Lauridsen, who regularly treats the endangered birds closer to their usual home on the Cassowary Coast, says this bird might do just fine.
They do live up on Cape York, and there are some scattered populations up there, and they do travel between sort of those rainforest sections across some sort of pretty dry sort of eucalypt open scrub. So it's not completely crazy that it could live there for a while, at least. What we do know from cassowaries, from a lot of the work we've done, especially through the cyclones where there wasn't much food for them, they'll eat anything. They'll eat lizards, they'll eat frogs, they'll eat little birds, little eggs, little rats and rodents and that sort of stuff. And then they will eat seed. We typically think that a cassowary eats just sort of rainforest fruits, but that's far from the truth. They eat all sorts of stuff.
As for how it ended up in the savannah, Dr. Lauridsen believes it's highly unlikely someone moved it there.
Part of my work is literally moving large birds from place to place when we've rehabilitated them or when they've been injured. That's not easy to do, especially this is quite a large adult bird. It'd probably be, at a guess, probably 50 to 60 kilos, and they can put up a fair fight. So I'd find that almost impossible to believe, unless it was caught in a trap or something like that. But even then, I think that's probably very unlikely.
Emeritus Professor Jones says tracking the bird could yield amazing insights, but actually getting the tracker on would be tricky.
It takes months sometimes to organise those things. You've got to put them into a place where you can bait them and attract them and eventually catch them. And even doing that can be risky to everybody involved as well. But please, if there's anybody from out there that knows about this bird, just keep your eyes on it and ring into the department and let them know where it is and how it's looking and all those sorts of things. This is such an unusual situation for an animal, an iconic animal like this one. We've really got to find out as much as we can from the situation.
Queensland's Environment Department has described the sighting as unusual and well outside the bird's normal habitat, but a spokesman says there are no plans to intervene and try to relocate the bird.
Uruman traditional owner David Hudson believes the situation is unprecedented, according to local elders, but he's happy for the bird to be left alone.
I'm just guessing that he's on some songline quest out to the savannah country, and if he's still out there, he's got a water source, he's got food source, I guess. He's got plenty of shade, he's got plenty of protection, he's got the lava tubes that he could venture into. I've got no concerns about him surviving out that way.
Reporter Shani Kim with that surprising discovery. And that's Australia Wide for this week. My name's Alex Barwick. A big thanks to the program's producer, Louise Mylan, and thanks for your company. Have a lovely weekend.
ABC Listen.